This is Nightlife with Suzanne Hill.
Do you have a friend who is different to you? Maybe you grew up on two sides of the tracks. Maybe you come from two very different cultures. Maybe your political views are the opposite of one another. Now, take the US former First Lady Michelle Obama as an example. Married to a Democratic former president who is a prominent figurehead for progressive values, here she is talking about someone who you might think would be a quite unlikely close friend.
He is my partner in crime at every major thing where all the formers gather. So we're together all the time, and I love him to death. He's a wonderful man. He's a funny man.
Yeah, now that is Michelle Obama talking about former Republican president and known conservative George W. Bush. They always have to sit next to each other, and yeah, they form this strong bond because they have to. But if unlikely friendships are a result of something as simple as forced proximity, then everyone you sit across from the office could be your best friend. And as you know, that is not the case. So what's really going on when opposites attract? Friendship-wise, are unlikely friends even opposites at all? Well, the likely people to ask are the two guests I have for you now. James Vella McConnell, who's sociology chair at Augsburg University in Minneapolis in the United States. He's the author of a book called Unlikely Friends, Bridging Ties and Diverse Friendships. And I've also got with me Dr. Elizabeth Yuko, who's a bioethicist, a journalist, and an adjunct professor of ethics at Fordham University in New York, who's written about history's surprise friends on history.com. James and Elizabeth, welcome to both of you to Nightlife.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Thank you.
Now, James, why are unlikely friendships such a rarity?
Our social environment shapes the opportunities that we have when we're making friends. So it could be the person across the hall. It could be the person you're forced to sit next to every time, right? We live in these neighborhoods. We go to these schools. We have these work environments. And the demographics of these places make a big difference in terms of who we're meeting and possibly making friends with. All of that occurs in a larger sociocultural context, which shapes our worldview, our values, our normative expectations. And these things tell us who we can or even should be friends with or not in the first place. Our existing social networks also impose limits because they too are shaped by these normative expectations. So this raises the question of how accepting our existing friends and family, our partner, our spouse will be when we're making a new friend who's different from ourselves. So all of these things play a significant role in who we make friends with. As a result, we're most likely to befriend those who are quite similar to ourselves in terms of social backgrounds, culture, values, beliefs, and so on. And we call that status homophily.
And I guess when you do have an unlikely friendship, as you're pointing out, there's kind of some extra work involved because you have to bridge those things. For example, you know, you're not in the same location. You're not going to always be meeting in the same place, in the same community group. So you have to put the work in with an unlikely friendship.
That's very much the case. Yes, there is a lot of work that you have to do, and you have to have a lot of patience with yourself in the process, right? And in many ways, you have to show each other a little bit of grace because sooner or later, you're going to make some mistakes and maybe say the wrong thing and so on.
Elizabeth, let's talk about things in common. It's not always about hobbies or interests or even professions. I want you to read part of a letter that Albert Einstein wrote to an admired friend, Marie Curie, when it was revealed she'd had an affair with a married fellow physicist in 1911.
Albert Einstein, yeah, he writes, "I am so enraged by the base manner in which the public is daring to concern itself to you that I absolutely must give vent to this feeling. Simply don't read that hogwash, but rather leave it to the reptile for whom it has been fabricated."
Now, we know Einstein was also a physicist who had numerous affairs himself. Is this just a case of excusing his own transgressions by proxy or something deeper?
Einstein admired Marie Curie's work prior to this happening, as they first met earlier that year, 1911, at a physics conference, but didn't really interact much. And then when Marie Curie was going through a rough patch, first, she wasn't accepted to the French Academy of Sciences because she was a woman and because she was Polish. And at the same time, she also was having an affair with a younger male married colleague, and the public turned against her. So this was something that Einstein was used to, but not exactly, because we don't get mad at men for extramarital relationships like we get mad at women. So Einstein wrote this letter to Marie as a way of supporting her. And that is what led to their friendship.
Okay, right. And how did it go from there? Did they become lifelong friends?
They did, yeah. So they had a lot in common, other than both being physicists. They were both immigrants. So Marie Curie was a Polish immigrant in France, and Einstein was Jewish and was moving up across borders constantly, looking for a place where he felt safe and taken seriously as a scientist. And they remained friends until Curie's death in 1934.
I'm talking to Dr. Elizabeth Yuko, who's a bioethicist, journalist and adjunct professor of ethics at Fordham University, and James Vella McConnell, who is the author of a book called Unlikely Friends, Bridging Ties and Diverse Friendships. James, can you give us some examples of how unlikely friends that you spoke with told you about how they bridge the social distance between them?
Sure, I can do that. I didn't interview anybody famous, so these are just average, everyday kind of people. One friendship pair I'm thinking of is Irene and Bao. Irene is African-American, Bao is Hmong. They come from completely different backgrounds and upbringing. They met in college, and at first they didn't really know what to think of each other. In fact, they had a lot of stereotypical views of each other, but they discovered that they had something in common, and that was that both of them felt disconnected from their own group. Val felt disconnected because she was pursuing a master's degree when she came from a family and a culture in which women are expected to get married at a young age. Then they would stay home and raise the kids. Irene was adopted and raised by white parents, and they tried to foster a cultural connection with her African-American roots, but it remained superficial at best. So this sense of disconnection that they both had was something that they actually bonded over, and then the friendship grew from there. Another friendship I'm thinking of would be between Dave and Tom. Dave is gay, Tom is straight. They met on the job, both work as airline pilots, which is a profession that Dave considers to be very straight. They became friends before Tom knew that Dave was gay. So the major challenge that Dave faced was whether to come out to him, right? This meant potentially putting the friendship at risk and creating awkwardness on the job. But it turned out that Tom was someone who considers himself to be straight but not narrow. So their friendship succeeded and expanded beyond being mere work colleagues.
James, I'm interested. I think in the US, there seems potentially greater racial divisions than there might be in other countries. How common or uncommon is it to have friendships that actually cross the racial divide? And can those sometimes be actually seen as taboo in the US?
Yes, great question. When you look at the data in all of the research that's out there, friendships that cross racial and ethnic lines are the most rare when you're comparing one type of demographic variable to another. Gender and class would be right behind that. And then you have things like age and sexual orientation, although there's less information, less research about friendships crossing sexual orientation divisions. But yes, race is very much the most difficult apparent boundary to overcome between different people.
Now, Elizabeth, let me go back to you because you've got a wealth of stories about famous unlikely friendships. The next one I might get you to tell us about is Helen Keller. She's actually got a couple of unlikely friends. One is Alexander Graham Bell, and the other that we're going to talk about is Mark Twain. Tell us about her relationships with these two people and why they were unlikely and why they succeeded.
So Helen Keller was probably best known as being a disability activist, a lecturer, and was deaf and blind. So she met the Scottish-born Canadian-American inventor and scientist Alexander Graham Bell, who we know best from inventing the telephone, in 1886 when Helen was 6 and Alexander was 39. And so Alexander Graham Bell spent a lot of his time trying to improve the lives of deaf and hard of hearing people, especially deaf children. And he had personal interest in this because his mother was hard of hearing and his wife was deaf. Not to put negative spin on this, but at the same time, it's probably helpful to acknowledge that Alexander Graham Bell, he tried to help deaf people, but at the same time, he opposed deaf people getting married because he didn't think those genes should be passed along to the next generation, making him a bit of a eugenicist. But people are complicated. So Alexander Graham Bell referred to Helen Keller to the Perkins School for the Blind in Boston and also made arrangements for her to meet Annie Sullivan, who was her future teacher and her lifelong companion. And over the years, the two did develop a close friendship. They visited each other. They traveled places together, like the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. And when it came time for Helen to go to college, she was having trouble paying for it. She went to Radcliffe College, which is part of Harvard, and Alexander Graham Bell helped pay for part of her tuition. And they remained friends until Bell's death in 1922.
What do you think made that work? Why did they end up becoming close friends?
I think because Alexander Graham Bell was especially interested in working with deaf children, and Helen wasn't just deaf, but also blind. For him, as a scientist and an inventor, he was curious about how to help her and just trying to make her life better and more functional.
Now, what about Helen's friendship with the writer Mark Twain?
So they met a little bit later in Helen's life when she was 14, and they met at a luncheon that a mutual friend held for Helen. And Mark Twain was enamored by her and just thought she was such an intelligent, creative young person. And once again, when it came time for Helen to attend Radcliffe College, when Mark Twain heard that she was having trouble affording it, he got in touch with someone who got in touch with the Rockefellers of Standard Oil and convinced them to pay for some of her tuition. In their case, both Helen Keller and Mark Twain were both interested in radical politics. On the other end of what they don't have in common, Helen was the eternal optimist, and she would make fun of Mark Twain sometimes for being such a pessimist. And one thing that Mark Twain had said about Helen is that she was the most wonderful person of her sex that has existed on this earth since Joan of Arc, which is pretty high praise.
Wow, that is high praise. You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio. We're talking unlikely friendships. I would love to hear about yours. Do you have a friendship that has really crossed some kind of barrier, a social, a racial, a cultural, perhaps a religious barrier? 1-300-800-222, or the SMS is 0467-922-702. Now, perhaps one of the ones you might think of in an Australian context is the relationship between journalist John Safran, who's Jewish, and Father Bob, who was a Catholic priest and community advocate. They've gone in many a stoush over the years, like this one.
We can't take all the days of the year off for every religion, but I mean, usually...
Surely the 8 days of Hanukkah, though, we can take those off.
That. But you've been around, so you lot have won the ride because you've been around since the beginning. Then we've won the right because we've been around for a couple of thousand. Islam's won the right because it's been around for 1,200.
What about the Scientologists?
And the Hindus have won the right, but see, they've got a problem because their calendar runs to about 3,485.
You think we can get through 1 week without you bagging the Hindus?
You started with Ganesh. I never heard of Ganesh before I got mixed up with you.
It was a kind of tense dynamic, but they became such good friends that John flew back from LA to Australia to give the eulogy at Bob's funeral. James, how do people overcome differences with something as sensitive and personal as religion, which has been the cause of centuries worth of conflict and bloodshed, and which people are often quite defensive about too?
This is a complicated one. That social cultural context that I mentioned before can be very powerful and actually prevent friendships across religious lines like this. If a worldview which says that people of different faith backgrounds can never really be friends, then a whole set of normative expectations are put in place to prevent that from happening. That's not to say that it's impossible, however, but something else has to make it possible. I'm thinking of another friendship pair of those that I studied between Deborah and Fatima. Deborah is Jewish, but she converted to Judaism from Christianity. Fatima's Muslim. And from Pakistan, she grew up in an area where her family had friends and neighbors who were Hindu and Christian. They became friends due to common interests in books and movies, philosophy, and learning new things. And early in their friendship, they didn't really focus on their religious differences until Fatima shared her wedding album. And I thought this was such a great story. This opened the door for them to talk about religious rituals and traditions in each of their faith backgrounds. And they described how in the process they were amazed at discovering the similarities between their respective religious traditions. Of course, they realize there are important differences between their faith systems as well, but that's not what they focused on in their friendship. When it comes to religious conflicts in the Middle East, for example, Deborah specifically highlighted how she thinks that the hate and distrust are political and based on geography and resources, but this becomes disguised with the cloak of religion. But yes, religion can be a very powerful source of division.
What about age? I mean, John and Bob were 53 years apart in age. Can age difference be considered a gap that needs to be bridged in a friendship?
Yes, this is due in part to how age segregated many of our social environments are. A notable exception to that would be the workplace. Here, there's more opportunities to interact with people of many different ages, which ups the odds. On the other hand, these age differences at work often go hand in hand with status differences, which makes it more complicated, right? There's also the question of the generation gap. If you're pretty far apart in age, our cultural reference points, even our language, could be very different from one another. But again, these differences don't have to be insurmountable. Many people enjoy interacting and learning from those who come from what, in a sense, are different worlds and cultures based on age.
James Bella McConnell is here, sociology chair at Augsburg University in Minneapolis in the States, author of Unlikely Friends, Bridging Ties and Diverse Friendships. And Dr. Elizabeth Yukob is here too. He's an adjunct professor of ethics at Fordham University. Elizabeth, tell us about Eleanor Roosevelt and Amelia Earhart. That might be considered a surprising friendship.
I think so. And it's probably my favorite pairing. So Amelia Earhart, the famous pilot, met First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt at a White House dinner in 1933. And these were two of the most visible women of the 1930s in the United States. And they were both admirers of each other's work. So it's not surprising that they became fast friends when they met. Eleanor was very interested in aviation. And one night at a dinner at the White House, Eleanor and Amelia sneaked away so that Amelia could take her up in an airplane. And Eleanor Roosevelt was so inspired by Amelia Earhart that she wanted to get her own pilot's license. And of course, Amelia Earhart agreed to give her flying lessons. Until the Secret Service and FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president, put a stop to their plans and said, no, this is probably not a great activity for the First Lady. Maybe find a different hobby. So between 1933 and 1937, when Amelia Earhart's plane disappeared, the two visited regularly, usually at the White House. And Amelia Earhart got involved with a lot of Eleanor Roosevelt's causes, like improving the lives of working women and promoting human rights and world peace.
Now, James, I want to talk about politics because that's another very divisive one. I remember listening to an episode of This American Life years ago in which they were sort of talking about people in the same families who had different political views. And both sides, both people who were Democrats and people who were Republicans, could not understand the other side. They both genuinely thought that their side was, you know, the best, and they just couldn't even contemplate how the other member of their family could imagine that the other side had the right views and the right approach to life. But it seems in the States that might be even more difficult to kind of bridge those divides. Now, why is politics so divisive? What stands out for people who bond with each other despite their differences in political views?
You're right. Politics is incredibly divisive right now. In many ways, I feel this is because we interact in increasingly homogenous social worlds. And that's not just in terms of demographic backgrounds. We often hear about the echo chamber of social media and the internet. And I don't think we should underestimate the power that that has. Not only are we less exposed to differences of opinion and values when we inhabit these echo chambers, but we also seem less willing to listen to each other when we are interacting with people with very different political views. Plus, the norms around us have shifted so that compromise seems to be less and less acceptable, and people are just digging in their heels and refusing to budge. But again, like with religion and with age, political differences aren't insurmountable.
Something that's appeared to emerge in some of the examples we've been talking about is that if you joke around with each other, that seems to be a key factor in creating one of these unlikely friendships. Elizabeth, what do you think about the role that humor plays in forming and sustaining unlikely friendships?
I think it plays a really important role because it's a way for both people to be vulnerable and to have some fun. And that can go a long way with someone that you might disagree with or have a different background from. And that definitely was the case, Helen Keller and Mark Twain especially. I mean, we know Mark Twain for his humor, so that's not surprising. But yeah, a lot of time it was Helen Keller ribbing him about being a curmudgeon. That definitely helped in their relationship.
James, what are your thoughts about humour and its importance from the people that you've spoken to?
I think it's a great way to grease the wheels. I would say fully a third of the people that I interviewed for my research, for them, humor played an important role in their friendship. And it wasn't just any kind of humor. It was actually humor that focused on the difference between them, right? And so they might be different in terms of race. We're not talking about racist humor. We're talking about humor about race, right? And so in the process, they kind of had to negotiate with each other without actually feeling like they're negotiating. And ultimately, friends would settle upon some basic rules, right? You have to establish some parameters on how far can you go with the humor. So for example, in the friendships where they talked about this, they had to establish trust and familiarity with each other first. And then an important rule was that outsiders were not welcome to that sense of humor that they shared with each other. So others couldn't just jump in and participate in this. They had their own system between themselves, right? And the use of humor had to be mutually acceptable, and they established rules about how far you could go with that. But I think most important is that the sense of humor had to be tempered with mutual respect and affection.
James, finally for you, how should we approach social difference in our own lives? What are some of the things that we can put in practice to go beyond it and create a greater chance of having one of these unlikely friendships?
Well, I wouldn't set out to make friends with somebody just because of their difference. Like, I want to make a friend with somebody because they're different in terms of X, Y, or Z. But you do have to be open to it. You have to be willing to go to move about in diverse spaces, what sociologist Elijah Anderson calls the cosmopolitan canopy. We have to acclimate ourselves and become comfortable with these kind of cosmopolitan spaces. I would say first, focus on what you have in common. Be ready to make mistakes, learn from those mistakes. You have to be willing to show each other a little bit of grace in that regard. And I think a very important rule here is you have to be willing to meet your friend more than halfway, right? We always hear about meeting somebody halfway. When it comes to these diverse friends, you have to meet each other more than halfway. You have to really make an effort and show your commitment to each other.
James and Elizabeth, thanks so much for being on Nightlife tonight to talk about unlikely friends. James, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And to Dr. Elizabeth Yuko, thank you too, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
That's James Vella McConnell, sociology chair at Augsburg University in Minneapolis in the US, author of Unlikely Friends, Bridging Ties and Diverse Friendships, and Dr. Elizabeth Yuko, who's a bioethicist, journalist and adjunct professor of ethics at Fordham University.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.